Hello, this is the Philosopher's Zone on RN Summer. Today, sex, flies and fairy tales.
The power of and the unsettling quality of insects is that they, I think, return us to the sense that an organism isn't a whole thing, that it has edges. There's a kind of unsettling quality about insects because they're always unravelling the boundaries that we draw around ourselves and the environment.
People with entomophobia live in fear of insects. Undina Selbach is not one of them. In fact, the Launceston-based philosopher and performer wants to get as close as possible to that which creeps, crawls and buzzes. The result is a philosophy of the undergrowth, where biology meets psychoanalysis via children's stories. You've homed in on small instinctive animals. Why are they interesting? Why insects?
Well, I think insects are always proximate to us, but on the periphery of our attention and our focus. And it struck me how absent, in a sense, insects were from discussions in ethics, but also even in discussions about the environment and in public debates generally, and yet how proximate they are to us in an everyday sense. They're there whether we like to think it or not, squashed up into the food that we eat. They're there in our kitchens and in our homes. They're also affecting us, so our own instinctual reactions are bouncing off kind of the insects that are around us. We rely on them also. How we came to, for example, know about DNA, it was through experiments using fruit flies. And so they're there all the time, and yet they don't kind of tend to register or be a focus. And so this really fascinated me.
I had an instinctual reaction then to when you said they're proximate. Oh, yes. What do you mean they're proximate and they're with us every day?
Well, I think they are. I mean, there's most likely an insect in the room at the moment for me and for you and for most people who are listening as well. So they're there, but they're too small or perhaps too hidden away for us to see a lot of the time. So that's a sort of physically proximate. But they're also there often as a kind of hidden part in processes of agriculture, you know, whether it's in a kind of negative presence through pesticides that at least apparently get rid of insects as a visible presence in our food. And we're also ecologically incredibly dependent on them. So, and I think what particularly interests me is that this happens at very many different registers. So it happens at the level of, you know, biology and at the level of science, and you can think about it that way. I think you can also think about it psychoanalytically when you start to think about our intense instinctive reactions when we're often confronted with insect behaviours. And you can also think about it once you start to pay attention, and this is something that really interests me, in the encounters between children and insects, because I think this is where there is a kind of open and quite productive engagement with insect life, you know, prior to a kind of closing off from the activities of bugs and the reactions that they kind of elicit in us, which we tend to either ignore or occasionally sensationalise.
You talked about the psychoanalytic, and I know that you look at Freud's work on the vicissitudes of instinct.
Yes.
What is it that you're looking at in particular there and trying to explain?
I think that at the beginning of this project, when I was thinking about insects and the strange ways that they're very, very present in our lives, but that we actually don't entirely know how to attend to this, and this was through conversations with Stephen Liu, who I work with as well, I began to think about how they are very aligned with instinct, both their own very particular instinctual behaviours and also the way that they kind of elicit instinctual reactions, very intense reactions, often of disgust in us, but also perhaps of wonder and fascination. And so this sort of led me to start to think about Freud and to also think about his essay, which is called Instincts and Their Vicissitudes. And what is very interesting about this essay is he sees within the kind of interior experience, the psychic kind of experience of instinct, that that is in some way in debt to external forces and processes in the outside world. And so that is when he develops an idea of the vicissitudes of instinct. It's a way of saying that human instinct isn't just an internal state, an internal psychic state. It is in debt for its power, in a sense, and its mutability, its capacity to shift to external forces. And they might be environmental, they might be human constructions, and they might be very powerful social norms, but they also might be things like instinctive creatures such as insects that, of course, have agencies and worlds of their own.
Mm. So in your reckoning, why does that instinct attach itself to the insect in such a way? I mean, you use the term disgust, for instance, which some people feel, particularly when they think about particular kinds of insects. How does that link one to the other?
The power of and the unsettling quality of insects is that they return us to the sense that an organism isn't a whole thing, that it has edges. And in fact, that sentience, more broadly our own and the sentience of other creatures, isn't just a kind of discrete thing that we can pin down. So there's a kind of unsettling quality about insects, because they're always kind of unravelling the boundaries that we draw around ourselves, and also around the distinction between an organism, whether it's a human one or an animal, and the environment. So there's a kind of breakdown of that. But I think it is interesting, because while certain animals are associated with animal instinct with a very, you know, clear purpose to it, so, you know, the behaviour of some animals, for example, might make us think about kind of maternal love or care or something like that, the very nature of the kind of instincts that insects become imbricated in for us, it's a very, very fluid, unpredictable kind of instinctual drive that can't be pinned down and given a very clear social purpose.
Mm. To the biological, who was Jacob von Uxkull, and why is he important to your work, and why is he important to this understanding of insect or small instinctive animal life?
Well, Uxkull is a remarkable biologist and a founder of ethology, which is a form of animal behavioural studies. He's working in the 1930s, and he's sort of one of the first, I suppose, biologists to take seriously not only the question, say, what could an insect tell us about ourselves, what might pulling it apart and studying it tell us about the human being, but also what might matter for insects and for the other small creatures that he studies. And so he puts forward an idea which he calls Umwelt, which is this idea that every creature inhabits its own life world. It's a world of perceptions and sensations, and it's a world of orientations where certain parts of its lived environment are incredibly important and become a kind of, you know, site of significance, and other parts of its environment drop away and become a kind of indeterminate or indistinct thing. So I suppose the provocation of for Uxkull to the biology of the time and even to today is the sense that you can't simply practice biology and bracket off the inner life of the creatures you study as irrelevant or unimportant to biological inquiry. You have to find some way, and this is a difficult thing, to take this into account. And so for Uxkull, part of this means paying very careful attention to the perceptual organs of the animals that he studies, and also to starting to think what elements of the environment are important to that creature and how that creature starts to interact with them, and what things are unimportant, that things that may be, for example, very important to us.
To some degree, he has to take an imaginative leap to do this, doesn't he? Because it's not the usual biological field or laboratory study that he's undertaking here. For instance, he describes how a tick might see its world, and the way he describes it, he seems to bring it down to a couple of elemental signs that the tick has to work off. It can't see, it obviously has to rely on smell. and relies on objects around it and the feeling of those objects around it to actually prosecute its way in the world. It's an interesting way to do biology, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. And he tells this story of the life cycle of the tick in the form almost of a fairy tale. And so there is a tension in there because we think of this as a very kind of anthropomorphic mode, a very childlike mode, but it becomes a fairy tale that is sort of becomes stranger and stranger in a sense, because he's describing a world where what counts and is significant for us is not registering for the tick. But interestingly, the kind of mode of imagination he needs to draw on in order to, you know, get us to begin to think about this is the very kind of childlike fairy tale one.
Which is unusual, as I say, for a biologist. This idea of the Umwelt, I guess, is it a concept that's useful, say, in philosophy, or do you think that it is actually not conceptually precise enough to really use?
I think it has been incredibly important in philosophy. I mean, it's interesting that your point about it being not conceptually precise, I think perhaps in a sense you're correct. But to me, the openness about what the Umwelt of different animals might be also is what makes it a very productive notion for philosophy. And I suppose in one way you can really think about it in using the very much the language of science, and you can say, well, it's just a matter of identifying what signs, you know, perhaps to think in terms of biosemiotics or what markers of significance a creature is responding to, and you can map that out. But I suppose what interests me very much is that the very, very process of positing this Umwelt affects us back. It provokes our own kind of instinctual responses, and it, when we try and imagine these animal Umwelts that Erkskull posits, it disorientates us in a sense and reorganizes our own senses. And I think that Erkskull is very aware of that. And by describing his most famous book, which is A Foray into the Worlds of Animals and Humans, he describes it as a picture book of invisible worlds. And he literally constructs his book of biology to look and appear like a picture book as well. So there are chapters which are on the different senses, there are sections that are on time and they're on space, and within each of these there's a kind of childlike, playful experimentation in response. But it's not a response only as a kind of form of human exploration. It is a kind of, a necessary process, I think, for Erkskull when we're confronted with the reality that the human forms of sensing and perceiving, experiencing and categorising the world are not the only ones that are there.
And this is the point that you're trying to make as well, that there are other ways of being able to come to this understanding. One of them is through performance, another one is through perhaps the eyes of a child. And this is what he was doing to some degree with his work.
Well, I think that, I mean, Erkskull is very well known in a sense for, you know, bringing together biology and aesthetics. But I think that the kind of picture book frame of his work is often dismissed as a kind of fancy, as a nice little device to then get his readers to keep on going. Just as I think that, you know, often sort of science for children and the kind of use of devices to engage children with science, this is often seen as a kind of simplifying a complex material just for the purpose of engagement. And I guess I'm very interested in the idea that there is much more going on, and that in a sense, on the one hand, you know, what Erkskull is drawing attention to is that in the process of doing science and also doing the philosophy of science, not only are you investigating a field, but you are yourself having not only kind of cognitive responses, but sensory responses, perhaps reconfigure how you listen, how you attend to things. And so these different registers are all in play at once. And when you sort of think about Erkskull in this way, it's just a way of making that visible. And I think there are perhaps important reasons at the moment to be able to think about science and biology in that way. And I think this is very tied up with the fact that we have very, very powerful ways of imagining ourselves in disconnection from instincts, of our own instincts in disconnection from the activities of the other animals around us, and without thinking about our ecological entanglements and also our impact on those things and the potentially unpredictable implications of all of this.
Undina Selbach on the necessity to contemplate the lives of small instinctive animals. Today on the Philosopher's Zone, here on RN Summer.
I guess to me, one of the things that really set me on this path of thinking was attending an event at the Melbourne Museum, which was called Bugs for Brunch. And the idea of the event was to invite some children to a special occasion at the museum, and there they would learn about insect behaviours, about our ecological reliance upon them. And they would also be presented with, you know, philosophical arguments about perhaps, for example, the utility of eating insects instead of other kinds of meat. And there could be discussions about that. But of course, with the title Bugs for Brunch, there was a whole other level to the event. It was a curated meal. There was a lot of thought put into the moment when there would be bugs that were first offered to the children to eat. And there were processes of watching cooking happen. There were also insects who were alive and who were brought to the table sitting in platters and who were never eaten. And I suppose what fascinated me was that none of this seemed to be understandable from the traditions of animal ethics, because it was unclear whether it was definitively right or wrong to eat these insects. None of this seems to be picked up if you just think about philosophy, for example, as a series of arguments, or you think about science as a body of information that needs to be acknowledged.
It's interesting you say that we don't know, because of the way we deal with insects, we don't know whether it was right, it is right or wrong to eat them, or which ones to eat, or how to deal with them, because there isn't a set of ethical procedures built up over time around that. The menu was interesting from that event you're talking about, because it actually brought to the surface that you had polenta there, which had lots of insects already secreted in there, or there were chocolate bars, and there were going to be lots of fragments of insects in your chocolate bars.
Already in all of our chocolate bars, yes. Yes, that's right. And so I guess that this is what's so fascinating, that and it links back to what I was saying at the beginning, that insects are proximate in our lives, but in ways where it is very, very difficult and perhaps impossible to keep on paying attention to this. We sort of very much cover over that proximity and don't want to deal with it. And that has big implications, for example, to do with the ways that pesticides get used in certain areas of food production. So I guess what is interesting about an event like this is that it brings that proximity to the fore, but the proximity isn't one of a very, very easy reciprocity or a kind of mutual understanding. It's a proximity with an enormous distance built into it.
Mm. Fascinating. Your work on that entomological imagination has led you to your own performances. I wonder, I just recently saw for the first time Isabella Rossellini's Green Porno series online, which is an extraordinary set of work. Is it in this sort of regard? Is it this kind of what starts or what looks to be educative, but in fact is deeply immersive as an experiential way of understanding the lives of smaller animals?
Well, what I really love in Isabella Rossellini's short films, there's a series that's called Green Porno, and there's a series, more recent one, on maternal instinct called Mamas. And what she's doing is, you know, showing the incredible diversity, whether it is in terms of sexual behaviour of animals or maternal instinct, that exists. And, you know, obviously that sort of breaks down some of the very simple presumptions that we have about other animals and the way that we often appeal to them, you know, to reinforce certain ideas about ourselves and our own, say, maternal instincts or our own sexuality.
If I were a barnacle, a semibalanus balanoids, I would have a shapeless body and I would be stuck to a rock. I would have to develop a long, long penis. Penises. Different penises, all trying to get as close as possible to my eggs. to reach inside a female barnacle.
So all of that's going on. But what I love in her work is the conjunction, and I think this is what links her to Erkeskoul, between, on the one hand, a very attentive base in animal biology. So, I mean, she's actually studying animal biology at the moment at New York University, I think it is. So there's very, very kind of careful research in there. But rather than presenting it in a naturalistic way, like a nature documentary, for example, she's performing and acting out the sort of abstract, quite reductive, but nevertheless well-researched, thought-through accounts that science gives us of the behaviour of small instinctive creatures. And so she acts them out in a pantomime way. I think I read an interview somewhere where she said, "I want all my work to be the kind of thing that somebody in their own kitchen could act out and perform for themselves." And so to me, there's this sort of powerful conjunction where there's that careful research, but there's also the very explicit, strange and disorienting process of in a very improvised way, trying to act out these insect worlds.
If I were a bee, a queen bee, I would be very fat and do nothing else but lay eggs. To one of my little sisters, I would feed the royal jelly that would make her fertile, and one day she will become the queen.
So tell me about your performances that are built around this idea of trying to understand insect life.
There's a piece that I have performed a couple of times, and I'm about to take to a conference which is at the University of Paris at the Sorbonne. It's a theatre and philosophy conference, in fact. And this piece is called The Grasshopper Cabaret, and it's based around an experiment by Jacob von Erkeskoul. This is an experiment that he relates, and he's interested in trying to work out what the umwelt of the grasshopper is. He takes one grasshopper, a male grasshopper, in fact, and he puts him in an isolated booth next to a microphone, and he leaves the grasshopper, and the grasshopper begins to chirp. And then the sound that the grasshopper makes travels down a wire into another room, and there are a whole lot of other grasshoppers, female grasshoppers, and they hear the sound and they gather round the speaker. Now, nearby them, there's a third grasshopper who is also chirping, but he is under a glass bell. Now, what Erkeskoul's finding is that the visual cue of the grasshopper being present isn't important to the mates, it's the sound, and so this grasshopper is neglected. And so what Stephen and I do in this piece is begin almost as I have, as a kind of academic paper where we talk about this experiment and the significance of Erkeskoul, and then we invite our audience to perform the experiment with us. One of us plays the grasshopper who's under the bell. We have a truncated recording of the voice, which is in fact a recording that is a strange cabaret song, which I once wrote, but which we use. And this, again, is in keeping with Erkeskoul's kind of imaginative way of setting the scene, where he actually describes this whole scene almost as though it was a strange kind of interwar cabaret. And then we hand out little combs to the audience, and we perform this strange grasshopper cabaret, asking them to scrape their combs and fill the gaps in the truncated recording that is played. And something happens. We'll have to wait and see what.
Undina Selbach, philosopher, writer and performer based at the University of Tasmania, on the joy of insects. And you can find a link to her work on our site. Just go to the RN front page and find the Philosopher's Zone. More next week on RN Summer. The Philosopher's Zone team is Diane Dean, Charles McCune, and me, Joe Gelonesi. Time to buzz off. See you then.